You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 10th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Grimm, friend of the show, DC Bureau Chief of The Intercept. He'll be here to break down the results of the midterms. Is there an abortion mandate? Plus, did the New York Democratic Party screw over all of us? Particularly, did Andrew Cuomo do so, and others, resulting in a loss of the House, most likely. Meanwhile, Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker are officially headed to a runoff in Georgia in 4 weeks. I hope Warnock has, like, a good self-care routine, because it's just back-to-back election cycles, the most stressful situation possible.
He's only been campaigning since January 2021.
Oh, my God. In Nevada and Arizona, the Senate races are still not called, but seem to be trending in the right direction for Democrats. If all goes well, that would be enough to maintain the narrowest of Senate majorities. New data shows that Democrats drove turnout and won over independents by double digits in competitive Senate race states, in Pennsylvania and Arizona in particular. Lauren Boebert's House race is still too close to call. The margin between her and Democrat Adam Frisch is less than 100 votes per my last count. She's got to be, at the very least, crap in her pants, much like a customer at Shooters. Heyo!
Pork slider, much.
A little delayed, but I workshopped that one. Republican leaders want Trump to delay his presidential announcement until after the Georgia runoff on December 6th. Good luck with that. He's apparently pretty pissed that the New York Post has DeSantis on the cover. Said something like, "De future. Do better, New York Post." In non-electoral news, a slowdown in price increases may indicate that inflation has already peaked. Hopefully. After hours of oral arguments, the extremist Supreme Court is signaling that it might side against Native American tribes in the case involving family law, but that would have much broader implications for tribal sovereignty in this country. The Biden administration has reportedly denied Ukraine's request for advanced drones in their fight against Russia's war of aggression. But lastly, in better news for Ukraine, Russian military leaders have reportedly ordered troops to withdraw from the city of Kherson, which was seized by Russian forces back in February. So, all this and more on today's Majority Report, and a Majority Report Thursday. Hello, everybody. Welcome. It's been quite a week. Midterms week. We're all hanging by a thread, but
we've all been broadcasting.
Yes, we have. I was on Left Reckoning last night, so you guys should check that out for sure.
Records all over the place. We had big numbers with Emma and Cale Brooks of formerly Jacobin Show.
People and if you compare,
why is it when Emma V comes on Left Reckoning
breaks records? I don't know.
And if you compare our broadcasting numbers this week to the broadcasting numbers the previous week,
I'm just
you
asking.
See that more people like it. This is a reference.
Now that Emma's been on Left Reckoning, it went quite well. I think we can all admit that the numbers.
I mean, thank you for doing the advocacy on my behalf. We are referencing a Donald Trump truth on Truth Social that we'll get to probably in the fun half, where he's comparing raw numbers from his presidential election to Ron D's votes.
Ron D, not so impressive when you compare it to me in 2020.
to the presidential election, I totally trounced him. So that'll be fun. I wonder if he'll actually listen and hold off on his announcement until after the Georgia runoff. I hope he does not, but it could, like, what's it like in the Trump Mar-a-Lago gold conference room where all the chairs are impossible to sit in because they're just plated, but they're ornate and, you know, look good for his standards. And just trying to convince him not to do something, but appealing to his ego. Like, it'll be a much bigger splash if you do it closer to the new year.
Imagine having to be the one to tell him, like, hey, I know we wanted to launch this on the 14th, but there's a runoff now, and people would really like if you wait. It's like, excuse me?
I
already ordered all the flowers and the fast food. And
just Diet Coke in your face immediately. And by diet, I mean
Yeah,
Coke.
He puts a Mentos in the Diet Coke and points it right at the guy.
That's assault. It'll be interesting. We're still in a period where we don't know what the final total for the House or the Senate will be. Nevada is taking a really long time to count. But they have the mail-in ballots that they're still counting, and they seem to be trending in the Democrats' direction fairly significantly. So hopefully Cortez Masto holds on, because then the Georgia race would be for the 51st Senate vote, which would be good, because Mark Kelly is, even though it hasn't been called, it's very likely that he's going to maintain that and win in Arizona.
And what's kind of important about that, too, is it just, like, takes away a, I think we were talking about this yesterday on Tuesday, is it takes away a real marketing pitch for Herschel Walker if Arizona and Nevada go blue, because then Herschel Walker can't really be like, I'm the key to the Republican Senate majority if
right.
It's already decided. And also kind of not helpful, funnily enough, that Brian Kemp has already won, is because he also can't be like, Stacey Abrams is going to be governor, like, you need me in the Senate. Like, he if those two, one thing has already happened, but if those two things happen, I think he's going to have, like, a pretty hard time kind of being like, why should we really care that Herschel Walker is our senator?
Yeah, I hope that that's the case. I do think I agree with you that it benefits Warnock. And also, the margin is around 35,000, but Warnock did finish in the lead. Right. So there's that. But Daniel Nakanian is reporting that as of so far, there's 208 Republican seats that have been called, 191 for Democrats. And as of, like, if the race were to stop right now in terms of leads, the Republicans would have 220, or they lead in 220 and the Democrats lead in 215. So that's a pretty narrow margin, and much more narrow than I think a lot of Republican pollsters anticipated. But let's turn to some of the reactions to the underwhelming results for the Republicans. It was not a red wave. It was a pink rain cloud, many people are saying. And Biden was asked about this at during a post-midterm press conference. He was asked about how the United States will rebuild relationships with the world after Donald Trump's presidency. And the question surrounds Donald Trump, and you see that basically Biden laughs in this reporter's face at the framing of the question.
G7 conversation was tied to your predecessor, who is about to launch another campaign. So how do you reassure them, if that is the reason for their questioning, that the former president will not return, or that his political movement, which is still very strong, will not once again take power in the United States?
Well, we just have to demonstrate that he will not take power.
Well, if you heard that right, Biden was like, oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? And that's
Biden was feeling spicy yesterday.
He was feeling dark. He should have brought out the red LED light for this press conference. But, I mean, he has the right to take a victory lap here. And
the premise of the question is wrong. I mean, I think there's a lot of folks on the right who are starting to agree, like, we need to turn the page on Trump. Mm-hmm. And Samuel Moyne tweeted this out. The Trump era is finally ending. And I don't know if this is necessarily true. Maybe Trump has another, like, return to it. But he says, the Trump era is finally ending for both sides, which are now both forced to figure out how to build a majority without distraction or obsession. And I think that could be – that's interesting to think about, because I think that might actually be, for the first time since Trump entered the primary in 2015, like,
you're speaking way too soon. I mean, he's going to enter the race, and all the voters will go like googly eyed. It's like when, you know.
Yeah, it's not. I'm more interested in the fact that, like, some of the, you know, they're not fringe anymore. But I mean, like, I instead of going to how, like, you know, Ted Cruz or some of these senators or congressmen will spin these results, I sometimes look to how, like, you know, people like Mike Cernovich or like are reacting to this, and Cernovich is like, I'm done with Trump.
The intelligentsia.
I'm so sick of this shit.
Matt Walsh, Eric Erickson. I mean, these guys will ultimately all come in under the fold
of
Daddy Trump. Yeah, asserts.
I just think it's right interesting now, that they're at least, like, actually kind of calling him by his name in these frustrations.
Well, right now they're throwing a tantrum, right, but they'll all, like, come to heel. Ted Cruz
absolutely
did it when his wife was called ugly, and I mean,
Marco Rubio has been completely emasculated from the
world.
Yeah,
little Marco, you came and you were my water boy. But even conservative media figures, I mentioned this yesterday, but Glenn Beck was, like, crying hysterically about the prospect of a Trump presidency, and now he's crying hysterically on behalf of Trump and how much he loves him. So it doesn't take much for these authoritarian followers to be authoritarian. They're dealing with the fallout from it now, but once the voters go, I just can't foresee another scenario where they're not, you know, more – they don't return to Trump's feet.
Yeah, as somebody who does like to stir the crap, though, when Matt Walsh says stuff like criticizes Trump on Twitter, it's interesting the split you get in the replies, because, like, I'll say, hey, why are you, do you have Trump derangement syndrome or something like that? And I'll get likes from Trump supporters saying that. It's great.
Well, speaking of some of the media reaction on the conservative side, which has been universal in its fears and disappointment and anger about the results of the midterms. Here's Jesse Waters, who there's, of course, misogyny, latent, or not so much, racism embedded in what he's saying here. But there is a kernel of truth that I want to point out in his anger about the results. Here he is on Fox News on the 5. Yeah.
Bunch more House Republicans are going to come in through the West Coast. You think this is going to be a nail biter? They're going to have the House. It's not going to be the biggest margin of all time. It's going to be bigger than they say it is right now.
Yeah.
But this was a red wave. If you're looking at in Florida, Stacey's no longer with us. She's going to go back to writing erotic novels. Abbott won. Beto, bye-bye. Find another office to run. There's just not the hatred for Joe Biden that there is for Barack Obama and for the Clintons. There's not a hate Biden vote that's out there. You know, when you go with Trump's on the ballot, there's that hate Trump Democrat vote. People just don't feel the same passion against the guy that they also
maybe
feel.
He's probably a nice guy.
We need to take this off, but just, I mean, you can also view his anger there through the lens of, why didn't we do a better job with this? This is our propaganda outfit. It was easy with us with Barack Obama because of the whole black thing.
Right.
And with Hillary Clinton, we actually put the work in, blood, sweat, and tears, to make sure that the Clintons were synonymous with corruption in the United States.
You know the truth, though? Like, I think it is the identity things, because I think Bill Clinton, like, if he could have ran again, like, I think that guy would still win elections.
It's not one thing or the other, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, with Obama, it's pretty clear.
It's pretty obvious.
Black. But Hillary Clinton, there is a lot of internalized misogyny about her, but, you know, they built a narrative for many, many years.
Clinton crime family.
Decades, yeah. They were asking the Vince Foster question on Fox News. So keep going, but there is, like, there is truth to what he's saying here.
We have a problem demographically. Single women are voting for Democrats by 30 points.
37.
37 points.
Yeah.
And in urban America, they're cleaning our clocks in the cities. Cleaning our clocks. I'm not saying anything nefarious is going on, but they are cleaning our clocks in the cities. And we're giving it away. And the fact that these youth voters are coming in so strong on an off year is very concerning. It looks like they've been brainwashed. This new generation is totally brainwashed, because a lot of these single women vote 37 spreads for Democrats are teaching all of our younger generation in these schools, and they're polluting their minds, and then they grow up, and then they're in their 20s, yeah, so and then they vote for
Monday.
There's so much to get into, but like to call all this, like, this is all just in the purely like ideas, like, like these sorts of voting patterns are fairly obvious to anybody who is this age, which is like our potential for having children and these sorts of like major life events are structurally and economically like foreclosed upon relative like to, I mean, even just, I don't know how old Jesse Waters is, maybe 40, even like that age because of the financial crisis, 2008.
Well, Jesse Waters understands the mind of young women because one of them is his partner, a former intern of his that he took the air out of her tires by his own admission in right. order to keep her in the building so he could have a date with her. So he understands women. But I also love his perception, like all of these young women are teaching our kids because it's like a 1960s idea of what a female career is when you're in your 20s. They're all teachers until they get married, right?
I think it was Jess Tarlov who's like the, you know, for lack of a better term, token Democrat on the panel, who is like, Jesse, even she was like, all right, we gotta move on. Like,
I mean,
wrap this up,
Jesse. It's not that hard, Jesse, though. The reason young women are voting for Democrats by those margins is because of abortion. Yeah. And we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm about this in a second. Like, yeah,
they've been brainwashed.
We younger women want our bodies to not be ruled over by people like you. But
yeah, you've been brainwashed by the imposition of hurdles into your healthcare.
And I'm brainwashing all of you. So like I'm almost a super teacher because I do this over the internet, my indoctrination. But here we go.
Where are we?
We are coming to you for your reactions of anything.
I don't know. I can't get wrapped up in this. I don't see what the problem is. I didn't need a red.
All right. Well, so
even Gutfeld was like, I'm not touching this one.
Yeah, but Gutfeld's the only Republican commentator I've seen that has kind of downplayed some of this. If the Republican margin is as small as it looks, it's the second best case scenario that we could have had. The Democrats holding onto the House was always a long shot, but that was the best case scenario, and the Senate as well. But we're in the second best case scenario situation, which is hopefully holding onto the Senate and losing the House by a small margin enough to create dysfunction within the Republican Party and have them infight. And hopefully not enough Republicans will be able to hold the debt ceiling hostage in order to get cuts to Social Security and Medicare or any of the more extremist things. You can have more moderate Republicans in blue states who will defect. And Sean Patrick Maloney lost. So we're in second best case scenario territory.
Like I think like if you, especially in the midterms where there's sort of an expectation, the conventional wisdom that you're going to lose ground. For me personally, it's like at least the sort of squad and squad adjacent stuff swelled in size. Mm-hmm. So like that's the most important thing for me.
Yes. We'll talk about that with Ryan Grimm, but man, there and two really strong progressives in the House coming out of Pennsylvania, let alone we have Kasar and in Washington and
Frost.
Right, Maxwell Frost. So lots of great developments from this midterm cycle. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Ryan Grimm. We are back with a friend of the show, DC Bureau Chief of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm. Hello, Ryan. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show, and I'm sure you have a million things to do.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Oh, good. Well, I feel like we had largely avoided the mandate discourse until your article. So I really appreciate you you bringing the word mandate back into the conversation.
And not the vaccine kind.
No, not that kind. But we are talking about genuine medical freedom here, which is abortion. And you wrote a piece up at The Intercept about how, you know, exit polls have indicated abortion was the top concern that really put Democrats over the top in terms of what a lot of voters were prioritizing at the ballot box. And we saw Kansas earlier in the year, ballot initiative affirming this, and then on Election Day, Vermont, Kentucky as well, Michigan as well, the voters making their opinions clear about abortion. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that the major...
Montana too?
Oh, I didn't. Montana as well. Right, Montana as well. So it's just, I mean, is that the major takeaway on a national level from the results of these midterms?
It's the thing that changed it from a 30 seat pickup, which is what was being projected by a lot of these prognosticators, and Republicans were talking earlier in the year about like a 50. Seat pickup. I think a point that I was making earlier this week, and that like AOC actually made last night in an interview with me, that this also points to the value and the power of full employment as a politics, over and against the focus on inflation is worth teasing apart. But I think separate from that, if you imagine a world in which the Supreme Court does what the Supreme Court has done for the last 50 years, which is not overturn Roe v. Wade, I think you're probably looking at several dozen seats lost by Democrats, Republicans picking up and probably picking up some Senate seats too, probably Arizona, probably Nevada. And so in that sense, that's the gap. Like, that's the mandate. The difference was in that ruling and people's reaction to it. And so then there's a question of, well, what do you do with it? I mean, I would argue, well, it gives Biden a lot of room to run on, what he can do on, federal property when it comes to, helping with abortion access in states that have banned it. Clearly voters will reward Democrats for fighting on this. And then as AOC pointed out in her interview with me last night, there will be, if Republicans do end up taking over the House, and it's hilarious that it's an if at this point, it's very likely, but it's not, it's Thursday and it's not certain yet. Right. They will have it by a couple of seats. That those will be vulnerable Republicans. Like, we're talking about people in New York State who won by, just a couple of thousand votes. And you can hammer them week after week, Will you sign on with Democrats to codify Roe v. Wade? So they either, as she put it, they either feel so much pain that they let something get through, which I don't see Kevin McCarthy doing, or they lose in 2 years. Now, you could also, she floated a discharge petition, which you could, which means that people, indivisible members in congressional districts represented by a moderate Republican could constantly ask them to sign this petition that says, I want a House floor vote. And if you get 218 signatures on a discharge petition, the rule is you're supposed to get a House floor vote on the legislation. And then it becomes a Senate fight. So yeah, I think there's a big mandate that Democrats could do a lot with creatively.
Well, I mean, do you foresee them even approaching this in the lame duck? I know they're going to be dealing with the debt ceiling, and that probably should be priority one, just as a way to curb Republican obstruction coming up. But this is more from your perspective, this is more of a political cudgel for Democrats to use for that very slim margin of vulnerable Republicans in blue states where, all, you know, they can be pressured and then subsequently beaten based on that.
That is the minimum that they could do. They could also pass something in the lame duck and then say to Manchin and Sinema, like, come on, like, we got this massive mandate. Let's reform the filibuster for abortion rights. John Fetterman ran on overturning the filibuster and on full suite of abortion rights. He won. He's going to be in Washington in the beginning of January. So you tell Manchin Sinema, just do it right now because we can't do it again. If Republicans take over the House, we can't do it unless you do a discharge petition, which if you could get, let's say they end up with 213 Democrats. They only need five Republicans at that point to say, okay, you know, I do support abortion rights. And then, McCarthy would, if the discharge petition got 218 signatures, he'd have to put it on the floor. He doesn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Then it would go to the Senate. And then if Fetterman, you know, you've got Fetterman,
right.
Warnock wins, Nevada and Arizona go Democratic, you've got 51. So at that point, it's on Sinema. Forget Manchin. You don't need him anymore. Sinema has said that she opposes changing the filibuster to do abortion rights because it would allow Republicans perhaps to ban abortion. That ship has kind of sailed.
Mm-hmm.
So make her take that stand. You know, get it through the House, get 49 Democrats on board, and say, Kyrsten Sinema, in a primary, you're running a primary against Ruben Gallego, are you going to be the woman who stands in the way of codifying Roe v. Wade? If you are, okay. We did everything we could. We pushed it as far as we can. Now we're going to knock you out in this primary.
Oh, yeah.
She might say, you know what? Yes, fine. Let's do it.
Right. I mean, I love this idea because for that very reason, because there might be not one Democratic senator who's going to be feeling the heat more in this next year and leading up to 2024 than Sinema, just because of how her home state has rejected broadly the Republican Party this election cycle. More and independence, you saw how I saw in the Wall Street Journal they broke for Democrats by double digits this time.
Mm-hmm.
And there already is a lot of institutional pressure on her as well. So that she definitely seems like of those two, the one that you could push more. It's just like she's so mercurial that it's impossible to know what the success rate is. But at the same time, there's actually literally no downside. There's only political upside for the Democrats.
Right. And it forces her to pick a side. And in a Democratic primary, it means that she either votes the right way, gets it done, or she loses her primary. And then she can try, I've heard people worry that, well, she'll just switch parties. That Arizona Republican Party is so crazy. They are happy to see her cause problems for Democrats. They love that. They absolutely do not want her as a Republican senator. Like, she's nowhere near far right wing enough for them.
Mm-hmm.
So then that would leave her trying to run an independent bid, and maybe she could do a spoiler campaign that would screw over Democrats because you can't rule that out. In that sense, I think the Senate should do it anyway. Like, I hadn't actually thought about this either, but so let's say they do come with 51 seats. Schumer should do it. Schumer should, you know, reform the filibuster, codify Roe v. Wade so that the whole country can see. So A, you put Sinema on the block there and force her one way or the other. Let's say that she does agree to do it. You codify Roe v. Wade. Now the Senate has passed it. Now you've got five Republicans standing in the way of the codification of Roe v. Wade, five House Republicans or whatever the number ends up being, those Republicans will get asked about that everywhere they go. And so they will either buckle and codify Roe v. Wade, or it will be the defining issue for them in their reelection campaigns.
I mean, this is what I wanted them to do with the marriage equality bill that passed the House and was being negotiated for weeks and weeks with the bipartisan group of senators in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And Schumer was insistent that he didn't want to bring it to a vote until it failed. And it could have been used as, and who knows if this would have made a difference, but the Barnes and Johnson race was not that far apart. Like, it was not mm-hmm. a shellacking by Ron Johnson, and he was visibly uncomfortable when being asked about marriage equality. I would have loved if Schumer would have made him take that vote. And this is, I think, kind of an extension, what you're arguing is an extension of that kind of thinking.
Yeah. No, that would have been great. And so this is like, you know, electoral politics and gamesmanship that could also lead to the codification of Roe v. Wade. So it's not, you're not just playing around here.
Right.
Like this, if this goes right, it actually leads to abortion rights being written into federal law. At a minimum, it's electorally beneficial, but it could also quite reasonably work.
Yeah. I mean,
Matt.
Well said. Like I'm just so used to nothing happening in the Senate that like my go-to immediately is the electoral ramifications, but that's the reality of it.
Yeah, and the counter argument from some Democrats is they don't want to give some senators the opportunity to vote the right way, like some Republican senators. Mm-hmm. But so look who's up. Class of 2018's Tester. I think that probably helps, or maybe it's a wash for him. Sherrod Brown. Is up. Manchin is up in 2024. He can vote against it. So he can show his independence if he wants to. But who are they going to beat? Like Susan Collins? No.
Either way. I mean, I just remember like this was a much
more
beneficial.
She's not even up until 26 anyway. Yeah.
Right. This was a much more beneficial year in terms of who was up for reelection than will be in 24. But, you know, 23 Senate seats to the Republicans 10 in the next election cycle.
Who are the? Do you have the Republicans there?
I'm doing it now. I'm looking at it now. But Sinema's up in 24. Feinstein. You have Rick Scott, Mike Braun, Josh Hawley. Marsha Blackburn, Ted Cruz, Romney's
yeah,
up again.
Yeah. I'm looking at this map. Not a single one of these Republicans would vote to codify Roe v. Wade in a cynical way for electoral benefit. All of them would vote against it.
Yeah.
And none of them are vulnerable anyway.
Well, let's turn to some of what you also talked about with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in your interview, because I mean, this is also one of the major stories of the election. A few states where the Democratic Party just completely... I could go on a whole rant about what the hell the Florida Democratic Party is doing. I mean, you see some of these numbers about how DeSantis just flipped +8 Biden counties that were majority Hispanic to +11 DeSantis counties this time around. And, you know, good thing that we ran the Republican against the Republican and people chose the real thing. That's always worked out super well for Democrats. But besides Florida, the major story of Democratic Party failure on a statewide level in this election is New York. And AOC just like kind of reaffirmed her calls for the head of the New York State Democratic Party, Jay Jacobs, to resign. Let's start there because with Democrats likely losing the House by a small margin at this point, you can really trace the origins of that back to New York.
Yeah, if the Democrats don't hold on to the House, it will be because of New York, the New York machine, where Sean Patrick Maloney, the DCCC chair, also happens to represent, and lost his lost his race. You saw a sweep in Long Island, some of it was avoidable had they managed to talk Tom Suozzi, who's a kind of centrist Long Island, but popular incumbent. He decided to run for governor, which was absurd. That was just absolutely not happening. And then they ended up losing that seat. They lost some of them. New York District 1, they lost by 40,000 votes, 2 by 50,000 votes. But District 4, which is closer to the city, they only lost that by 4 points. District 3, which was Suozzi's, they lost by 8 points, so Suozzi would have carried it. But then out in Western New York, they lost in District 19, they lost just 51-19, but 2 points. Maloney only lost his by, a point. And then there's two other races, New York 22 and New York 22 that they lost by a point, and then New York 2021, Stefanik won it pretty easily. Pat Ryan seems like one of basically the only one in New York won this close race, who ran on a real, corporate accountability agenda coupled with strong support for abortion rights. But this also goes back to the redistricting, like you were talking about. This was a redistricting ordered by Cuomo appointed judges, written by some right wing dude in Pittsburgh, after the state party decided not to challenge not to back a referendum in 2021 that would have basically made it impossible for those Cuomo judges to do that. But yeah, just a complete disaster. You're talking about 5-6 seats in New York alone due to their kind of corruption and incompetence.
Well, so what was their motivation for not doing that? Because, I'm pretty clear on the origins of why we're in the situation with, one, the judges, and two, why it was punted to this point, which was that Cuomo essentially, as a part of this bargain that he had, made a deal with state legislatures that gave them the capacity to redraw their own districts that would favor them. Then it was punted 10 years down the line to an independent commission, and then Republicans sued so that it went to the state Supreme Court. And those were judges that were appointed by Cuomo as a way to appeal to Republicans, and they were conservative judges, and they ended up ruling with Republicans. But why in 2021 did Democrats not choose to cut that process off and and make lines more favorable for the next year? Didn't have the foresight to do it for the next year.
It's a good question. Reed would be that it goes back to them not really caring about elections. Elections for these corrupt machines, which, and New York's not the only one, but it's one of the most corrupt and the most sclerotic, they're an annoyance to them. They're not into this to necessarily win elections for some ideological purpose or to make the lives of constituents better. They're in it to gain positions of power, to enrich themselves and their friends. To bring misery upon their enemies, both their personal enemies and their business enemies, and to then, have a nice, robust social calendar. They throw good parties. It's a very clubby kind of atmosphere, and that's what it is. And the elections are an inconvenience that have to be dealt with in order to justify the entire apparatus. That's a main reason why you have such low turnout. They even started moving, this cost helped Joe Crowley his seat. If you want to juice turnout, you put everybody's election at the same time, from senator down to dog catcher. What they figured out is that if we spread these out, then people have even less reason to show up to vote. So you'd vote for Congress on 1 week, and then down the road you'd vote for judicial seats, and then you vote over here for ward leader or whatever. And because they wanted as few people participating as possible, because they wanted to know every single person who was participating and be able to rely on their votes. That's why AOC was able to knock off Joe Crowley, winning, what was it, 16,000 votes or something?
Mm-hmm.
Just an utterly hilarious number of people.
He was turning out in his primaries like less than 10,000 votes before she was running.
Yeah, and he turned out less than 10,000 again.
I know,
She turned out like 12 or something. It was like the funniest, like lowest number of votes that you could imagine in a 700,000 person district. But that was by design because they don't want people participating. Because if people start participating, then they have to deliver for those people. And people will start asking questions too. Like you remember the IDC, that the Independent Democratic Conference, which was this collection of rogue Democrats who basically teamed up with Republicans to make sure that Republicans could control the Senate so that the power then flowed up to the leader of the Senate, the leader of the House, and the governor. That way, organized constituencies couldn't really push on the party to do something because they would say, well, we'd love to, but the Republicans and buzz. So that was able to fly, you know, for years. It was only after Trump that woke up a lot of Democratic voters, and then they started paying attention. You know, that huge awakening, 5 million people marching the day of the Women's March. After they came home from the Women's March, people were like, well, what's going on here in my district? What can I do to make my piece of the world a better place? And they would Google and be like, wait a minute, I have a Democrat who caucuses with Republicans? Mm-hmm. No. And so that election cycle, 2018, they annihilated the IDC. That's the last thing that they wanted. Putin, his success over in Russia has come from his complete demobilization of the political process. That's what the New York State Democratic Party signs. They've just completely demobilized their base, and that's how they want to keep it. Then along comes a close election, and now all of a sudden you're like trying to crank this rickety, rusty machine, saying, hey guys, actually it matters. Can you guys come out and vote, please? And as you saw, like not enough did. And it's going to cost them, it looks like it's going to cost Democrats the House and cost them the ability to codify Roe v. Wade.
What is Jay Jacobs's role in this in particular, the head of the New York
State
Party?
He's a Cuomo flunky who has just been, you know, he's very tight with the charter and real estate developer world, and the corporate kind of nexus of New York politics has been at war with the progressive wing of the party, a very vocal war, like very clear that he considers the progressive wing of the party to be a bigger enemy than the Republican.
Well, all you need to do is look at India Walton's election and what he did in there, sabotaging her directly.
She won a primary, and then the party switched its support and backed the guy who lost the primary.
Yeah. And so that's why AOC is basically saying that he should resign. I mean, she's been saying that for a while, but do you think there's more momentum given the pathetic, showing for the Democrats in New York?
It's a good question. The problem is that they're so, that the leadership structure that supports Jacobs is all vested in Jacobs sticking around because they're out. If he's out, and do they care that they didn't win the House? Do they care that they're going to cost the country the ability to codify Roe v. Wade? No evidence that they do.
It just is amazing to me that the tentacles of Cuomo, it's like they've been chopped off, but they're still squirming around, right? And his influence is, I know that it's not just him, right? But the people that he implanted throughout the state are still making their voices heard. And
absolutely.
Felt.
And some of them, in, I think, deliberately malicious ways as payback. But Cuomo had a lot of political skill. Whatever you want to say about him, just raw political skill. And so he can take a sclerotic system that is built for him, and he can sometimes deploy it skillfully, you know, in elections. Doing a Cuomo machine without a Cuomo just doesn't work. Just having the flunkies and lieutenants, like, you could make a very strong argument that the Cuomo machine with Cuomo is unethical, it's wrong, it's anti-progressive, blah, blah, blah. But at least it has some skill to it. Now you have all the bad parts and none of the skill, just flunkies.
Yeah. Right. Well, before I know you have to go at some point, but I don't want to just end on doom and gloom fully, because we do have some positive developments in the House, including the election of Summer Lee, who I was talking to Branko Marketich on Twitter about this, and you know, he was just pointing out how much, and we've talked about this on the show before, but how much AIPAC money was poured into her race, not just in the primary. They came in the general last minute to flood the zone with AIPAC money against her in Pennsylvania's 12th district. Mm-hmm. Her opponent has the same name as the Democratic representative, Mike Doyle, who is retiring, and he was running ads in Pennsylvania, not identifying himself as a Republican. Yeah. So people were voting early and thinking that they were voting for Mike Doyle, the retiring Democrat. And she overcame that. And Branko was saying, you know, she really crawled through barbed wire for her victory. I mean, have we both have kind of reported on a lot of these squad races, and it's hard to even think of another one of these races where more of the deck has been stacked against that particular candidate.
The other would be Nina Turner.
Right, but successfully.
For that reason is not.
Right. Right. Exactly. So just talk about that a bit.
The amount of money spent against her, calling her not a Democrat, very nearly cost her the primary. That AIPAC then went from calling her not a Democrat to actively supporting the Republican was just the absolute cherry on top.
Right.
And then in the district next door, and this is something that Akhil Lacey, my colleague, wrote about. So Chris DeLuzio was running in a swing district, and Republicans spent $3 or $4 million attacking DeLuzio, lumping him with Summer Lee. So, and in the same, and saying, you know, radical Summer Lee, like extremist Summer Lee is, and DeLuzio are like, you know, birds of a feather. And so that money doesn't show up in the ledger as being spent against Summer Lee, but that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of Pittsburgh residents constantly seeing Summer Lee get called a crazy radical extremist, even though the ads are for a different race. So not only does she face the millions in AIPAC spending in the primary, all the AIPAC spending in the general, but she also had to fend off that millions of dollars in DeLuzio spending that was also attacking her. And DeLuzio ended up winning somewhat comfortably, 53-47.
Connor Lamb's old district, where, you know, Connor Lamb is the poster boy in Pennsylvania. I believe this is Connor Lamb's old district, right, Brad?
No.
It's
Connor
not?
Lamb's, no.
All right, my brain is...
I mean, it's hard to say exactly what Connor Lamb's is because they move around so much, but you might be right. Maybe somebody could...
We said this on primary night, and I might, like, I don't even remember what I said at all that night, so...
It might not be the exact...
Because they've been redrawn so much, but...
Okay.
But yeah, he won.
Yeah, it might not be the exact lines. I think it just might be some of Lamb's old territory in Western PA. Yeah.
Either way, poster boy for only corporate centrism can win in this kind of district. And at the very least, DeLuzio, you know, had success with his more progressive pro-labor strategy, very similar with Summer Lee as well.
And the other one to badly undermine that argument is Matt Cartwright, who ran in Northeast Pennsylvania, like Scranton, Hazleton, the just stereotypical Trump country. And he's represented that district as a populist, progressive, Medicare for all supporter since 2012, which is so funny about Biden saying that back where I come from, that's not what they're for. It's like, well, actually, the guy that represents Scranton is for Medicare for all and keeps winning. And he faced a very well-funded, sophisticated challenge from this guy, Jim Bognet, a Republican. And he's going to hang on. It looks like he's 51-49. He's up by like 7,000 votes. Susan Wild, who represents the Lehigh Valley, is not a centrist, I was skeptical of her. I think you remember Greg Edwards, the Bernie-backed candidate in 2018 who challenged her.
Right.
She beat him in the primary. She's been a pretty strong progressive in Congress.
And there's some money in that district because it's like there's been some spillover from kind of suburbs that have – I went to college there, so I remember it.
Oh, where'd you go?
Lafayette.
Okay, my dad went to Lafayette. That's where I'm from, is Allentown.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Born in Allentown, yeah.
All right, well, yeah. There we go.
A whole bunch of family that went there. It's a gorgeous school.
Yeah, it's all right.
So anyway, she held on despite being progressive in that district in Allentown. And I'm sure buoyed by Shapiro and Fetterman, who did not do the Connor Lamb. Neither of whom did the Connor Lamb playbook.
Right. All right, before I let you go, one more fun thing. Lauren Boebert.
Lauren Boebert.
What are we going to... Last I checked, the margin has been less than 100 votes between the two of them. So I'm sure we're headed to some recount, but...
Oh, no, I'm looking at it right now.
She's back up?
Yeah. She's up by about 400 votes now.
Damn.
Oh, no. The prayers
no,
are working.
We celebrated too quickly.
It's not over. They're still counting, but I think a lot they're counting a lot of same day. I mean, election day voting, which even in areas that lean blue, the election day voting
right
lean red. But yeah, 743 to 357, almost a 400 vote lead for Lauren Boebert here. Who might?
Well, where are all these votes coming from? I mean, we just
stop the count.
The count. What's going on here?
But stop the count 2 hours ago.
Stop the count now.
This just feels fraudulent. I just feel it in my bones. I don't know.
I know.
All right.
You're starting to see that from people that like people are mad. It's impossible.
Yeah,
the result. I don't have evidence, but it's just impossible.
Well, Ryan Grimm, DC Bureau Chief of The Intercept, you can read his interview with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and also his piece on the abortion mandate for Congress. Really appreciate you coming on today, Ryan. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right, guys. That will wrap up the first hour of this program. We will head into the fun half shortly where we will be having fun. We'll be taking your calls, reading your IMs, doing some clips, talking even more about the midterms as breaking news continues to roll in. But Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Last night Emma Vigeland was on Left Reckoning talking about this stuff also. So if you need more election, response, also Cale Brooks of the Jacobin Show, I guess the recently departed Jacobin Show joined us. And so check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. I talked a little bit in the post game about how all these knives are out for Trump, including from people like Chris Rufo and Matt Walsh, who I think if the party has an incoherent message, it might be because spent so much time faffing about CRT and trans people. But patreon.com/leftreckoning.
And on ESVN today, Bradley and I have a lot to discuss in addition to our locks of the week, where it's amazing that Bradley has not lost in 3 weeks. He pushed twice, so your mic's not on. Yeah. So now that counts. I win. But I had a decent
My mic
weekend.
Was off, so that was my L. But I haven't lost a pick in 3 weeks.
Well, also, unreal. Emma beat me by 1.2 points in our fantasy.
That's so brutal. That's
I hate that.
Nail biter.
These kinds of, I don't know why we do this to ourselves, but you can watch us do inflict pain on ourselves on youtube.com/ESVN show at 4 p.m. today. We will also be talking about serious topics like the Mitchell Miller controversy in the NHL, a prospect who bullied to the point of expulsion and the law getting involved, a mentally handicapped black boy in his school who the Boston Bruins decided deserved another chance. And that's been met with a lot of outrage. Plus, Daniel Snyder being forced to sell the team now that he's under congressional investigation is blaming why aren't you going after all the crime in our cities instead of going after me, including my player who got shot? Yeah, he really went there and is using his own players as a human shield to deflect from his crimes, so alleged crime. So youtube.com/ESVN show for some of that. And with that, we don't have Brandon and Binder yet, but check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy. All right, we have Binder here. Great. Great. Hey, Matt. Well, we can't hear you quite yet, but soon.
Test. Oh. There we go.
There you are. Wow. Your hair's long.
Yeah,
growing
I know.
It out.
Yeah. It got
looks
very
good.
Thank you.
What's happening over on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Oh, well, this past Tuesday night, I was up very late. streaming, and I was on two different streams, and one is up on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/MattBinder. First, I was joined by Ben Burgess in a stream with a bunch of right-wingers.
Oh, fun.
Like Lauren Chen and Michael Tracy and Robbie Starbuck.
You mean Michael Tricycle?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and Destiny was on there too.
And Binder, was Lauren Southern there also?
She was supposed to be, but she never showed when I was on. I don't know if she was on earlier or later. I would have loved if she was on when I was on, but alas, she was not.
And no Sargon either?
Sargon did not show when I was on either, no.
What?
Yeah,
cowards.
It was really weird.
Afraid to debate. Afraid
I mean, oddly
debate.
Enough, when I was on, there was the same time that Ben Burgess and Destiny were on too. And I mean, I know Destiny's not, but he's much closer than those other guys in terms of, you know, ideology, I guess. I just thought it was interesting that we were just all on at the same time and wasn't as much headbutting in the beginning because there was just us for a little bit, but then more people came on. But then afterwards, that was fun. But then afterwards, the real fun began, and I'm going to upload that stuff on my channel next. I went on the Surf stream along with Mike of the Humanist Report, David Dole of the Rational National, R.M. Brown, and Vosh joined us for a little bit, and a whole bunch of other heads showed up. That one was a lot of fun, and that one went to like 3 a.m.
This is the night of the town, Binder.
Yeah, wow.
the night in the YouTube public square.
Mr. Social here.
Yeah, no, it was literally like a who's who without you guys. What were you guys doing? That was so important. You couldn't.
I was trying to figure out with Lance how we could join streams, but it was just, I at that point was also having difficulty managing our own stream.
Yeah.
Given my proclivities by that part of the evening, so I just
you had difficulties crossing the streams.
Yeah.
Yes.
Difficulties crossing. Ayo. Streams, given what else I was crossing. Yeah.
Well, then also on Scam Economy. Now this is where I had on Mike Bergersberg of Dirty Bubble Media Newsletter. Literally the guy who called out what's going on at Celsius before Celsius fell was the guy who called out Voyager before Voyager fell. And on Sunday night, the episode with Mike published on scameconomy.com and on podcasts platforms and on YouTube, youtube.com/MattBinder. And he told us all about how FTX and Alameda, Sam Bankman-Fried's little crypto empire, the multi-billionaire who pledged $1 billion to Democrats, was actually probably very insolvent. And just days after that episode dropped, FTX is basically down. And Binance is not going to bail them out like they said they were going to. And basically now Bitcoin has dropped to like 15K. The whole crypto market is in turmoil. Once again, people who had, you know, been trading on FTX, their money gone. It looks like Sam Bankman-Fried was borrowing $10 billion of customers' money from FTX to transfer over to his... Yeah, small loan to trade over, to send over to his trading group, Alameda, to basically make risky trades using money that clearly was not his. He's in a $10 billion hole. Dems probably shouldn't depend on that $1 billion to come through by 2024. He only dropped like $40 million so far of the billion he promised. Probably not going to get the rest. Just a heads up, guys.
All right,
so that's a scam economy.
The rest went towards Miami Heat Stadium, FTX Arena.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I cannot believe they did that to the Staples Center, too. But what was the guy's name? Burger Meister Meister Burger?
Mike Burgersberg.
Mike Burgersberg. It's a pen name. He's anonymous, but he's been...
like the guy from Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Anyway, Brandon, what is happening on the discourse?
We'll have a new episode for you this weekend, probably about the same topic that Matt was just talking about, because I am, you know, quite deeply enmeshed in this topic as well. And also the Twitter kerfuffles with Elon Musk and the various happenings surrounding the midterms.
All right, perfect. All right, we're going to head into the fun half now. Then we'll be taking your calls, reading your IMs. Maybe not a ton of calls today because it's a busy news week. 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough little breaks.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.